Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey friends, welcome to a special edition of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. We have been missing in action for a few days now, almost a month. But that's because we had the off season, whatever you want to make of that in the tennis world. But yeah, now I'm pretty excited because we're looking ahead to 2023. We're going to look at what kind of things that took place in 2022 in the players and, you know, get hyped for the next season. So I'm really happy to have Owen Lewis join me. How are you doing today, Owen?
I'm doing well. And yeah, we apologize for the lack of minute-by-minute recaps of various exhibitions going around the world. But yeah, you know, I'm also a little bit burned out. And like you said, there hasn't been, you know, an official big tennis event for ranking points in a little bit. So I thought it'd be fun to kind of reflect on the majors in 2022 and then look ahead to 2023, come out with some predictions. Yours will obviously be better than mine because that is how it's gone in the past. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about predictions is I equally love being wrong than I do being right because it just makes it so much more exciting, and it's already kind of very unpredictable at times, especially in 2022. I just felt like with the whole situation with like Novak not playing two majors and, you know, Wimbledon, you know, banning Belarusian and Russian players, it felt like there were some openings for a lot of players and there were some opportunities, and we'll look ahead to see like kind of who missed out, who took advantage of them, who is best suited for a great 2023. So all of that is really fun. It's a really fun exercise to do, right? But I guess we can start with the majors. In Australia, there were plenty of good matches on the men's and women's side. So what are some that, you know, maybe stood out to you and players that you look forward to seeing how they'll do this year?
That's a good question. I mean, I think Australia was probably the best major of the year to me. Like, as we know, for people in the US and various other places, it's horrible sleep schedule-wise. I basically those 2 weeks stayed up during the nights, went to classes during the day, and then slept in between. And I did 3 full all-nighters in the 2 weeks. And it was worth it because I saw a lot of great tennis. I think a couple that jump out right away are Naomi Osaka and Amanda Anisimova. I think in the fourth round, maybe third.
Yeah, third round.
Yeah.
Third round. Yeah.
That was just like a killer match, especially the last several points. Since they both hit such a heavy ball and they have so much easy power, they were just like blistering the ball in these cross court rallies. And then whoever pulls the trigger first would hit a winner down the line. And at the end of Anisimova just went nuclear in the last few points of the tiebreak and won, saving a couple of match points, which was interesting too.
Yeah, that's a great place to start because that was probably my best match for the women's side in the tournament, and I just felt like it had that added layer of excitement because the winner was going to play Ash Barty.
Yeah.
And Anisimova was in great form. Like, she had just won a title before. She was looking really good. I think she had Darren Cahill in her corner as well. And there were two match points that she had to save as well in that game before it ultimately went to the tiebreak. And Osaka was playing good. Like, it was a good version of Naomi. And Anisimova just came through, and like you said, just going for the backhand on the lines when she could. I love her backhand in general. I actually do think she had a very good year overall. It's just that towards the end of the year, she suffered another injury and couldn't really give her best at the US Open. But I think she made quarterfinals at Wimbledon, fourth round of Roland Garros, and fourth round of Australia, losing to Ash Barty. And I guess, winning a few games, which was really hard against Barty in that tournament, yeah, as we know. So I think it's going to be fascinating to see how both of them do this year, because I remember Anisimova when she first broke out on the scene. I think in Roland Garros 2019 is when she had a really big run, like got all the way to the semis, I think crushed Halep along the way, and then was up a set and 3-love on Ash Barty, and then Barty ended up winning the Roland Garros, and then her career took over from there. But she's really capable of a lot of great things. Like, I love her ball striking. She moves decently well. She has a good foundation. Reminds me a little bit of the ATP version of Jannik Sinner. They're both roughly around the same age. They're pretty good ball strikers.
Yeah.
I think she doesn't quite have the like generational type athleticism that maybe Sinner has, but she definitely is very good off both wings and can be a starting test for most top players.
She has more easy power than anyone on tour, really. Like, I think she's the player where it's most dangerous to leave a ball hanging. And because she can just demolish it, put insane pace on the ball from either wing. And, you know, obviously she can be a little erratic. But when she's on, I think there's no more dangerous opponent. And that reminder of Barty waiting in the next round, I had actually forgotten about. I remember I wanted to be annoyed at not getting an Osaka-Barty match. But the match between Anisimova and Osaka was so good that I wasn't annoyed. But in retrospect, I think it would have been really, really interesting to see that, because Barty just had such an easy time for the most part at the Australian Open. In the final, she was down 5-1 to Collins in the second set. But once she got going, I think she rescued that set pretty comfortably, 7-2 in the tiebreak. And, you know, Osaka has the game to challenge Barty. I think, like, she would give her issues in the backhand-to-backhand rallies. It's got a great forehand that could go toe-to-toe with Barty. One of the very, very few who could, like, maybe out-serve Barty. Now, kind of tragically, we're never going to see that matchup. Kind of transitioning to Barty, like, I had forgotten how dominant she was at that Australian Open. Like, she was not even dropping serve for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, she, like, won the tournament, I think, dropping just 30 games in total, and her only real test came in the final against Danielle Collins when she was 5-1 down in the second set and managed to pull that out. And now that I think about it, it's an even bigger accomplishment, especially she knew that she was going to retire before, like, after that tournament. And, like, it was pretty much Wimbledon. I think she had pretty much had her mindset on retirement after she won it last year. And then this year, this just felt like the icing on the cake. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what a shock that was for the WTA overall, like, when she announced her retirement. Yeah. And we thought we were going to be in for, like, several world number ones. And, you know, it was going to be, like, a really tough time transitioning for most players. And it kind of was in a way for the women's game, but Iga Świątek obviously had a lot of other ideas and just took the baton and just raised it to an absolutely new level where now some people are even having the conversation. It's super early, but some people are already talking about her as a potential GOAT, you know, because at the pace that if she keeps it up like this. But it's just so amazing how quickly the discussion became from who can beat Ash Barty to, like, who can beat Iga Świątek. It was, like, a matter of a month.
Yeah, and I mean, I think GOAT, or even a GOAT, is going way too far, way too early. But I think, like, an all-time great isn't out of the question, right? Like, I think kind of like you were saying already, Świątek now is sort of where Barty was after the Australian Open, you know? Like, three majors, world number one, picking up steam, sort of in that place where it's, like, there's a little bit of an air of invincibility even when they're at their best.
Right.
And she's in that phase of her career where she's not an all-time great yet, but if she continues on this pace, if she keeps improving, which would be insane because her game is already incredibly good, it's so easy to project, like, gigantic numbers of majors. But I think Barty kind of showed us the danger in making predictions like that, because I think her rationale for retiring made sense. Like, she had already achieved a lot. Why should she spend another 10 years of her life achieving a lot of the same stuff she had already done? Like, she ticks pretty much all the boxes. I mean, you know, career slam, like, 10 majors, she didn't do that, but who does? Like, five, more than five, but, like, a handful of people ever. Like, not everyone wants that.
Yeah, exactly. And she knew what she wanted, and it seemed like, you know, obviously the travel, the grind, the daily life of being a professional tennis player day in and day out on the tour certainly took its toll, and she was very honest about it. And definitely it's like, you know, she has achieved pretty much everything she wanted besides the US Open. But even in doubles, she made a major final of all four and won one. So it's like, and she had this insane number of weeks at number one, and she proved herself on all surfaces. So she was 25, and Świątek right now is 21, which is crazy because it's like, you might not even have seen the best of Iga. and what she's already doing is so generational, and you feel like she's so good on clay that it seems I'm already predicting that she'll win at least one major next year.
And yeah, I mean that feels safe, right? Like I feel like she'd even go at least two. I think she'll win in Australia because she hasn't won there yet. This year she wasn't the beast on hard court there that she is now. It's interesting to think about. I mean, because she is so young. Like it's not, and I feel like people will be annoyed at me for making this comparison, but it's not entirely different from like where Federer was like around this point of his career, you know, because he had that first year when he won the major. And then Iga had, she didn't win one in 2021, but then Federer has like this very dominant 2004 where he just like wins a ton of stuff. And after that, it's like, okay, he's the guy. How far can he go? And, you know, Iga's year this year wasn't as dominant as Federer's 2004, but I feel like she's in a similar place. Like when she's on, no one can beat her. She's fantastic on hard and clay now. I feel like she can get grass in the future. And it just feels like the entire world is just like stretched out there in front of her, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it takes a peaking performance to beat her and something out of the ordinary, like a Daniel Collins or, Ostapenko, firing those return winners.
Right.
And it's just like, okay, she didn't win the WTA finals and she lost in the third round of Wimbledon, but it's like, what she did like in between, she also went on a 37 match winning streak, like won six titles in a row.
37 matches. It's insane.
We've never seen that before in this century. So it's like, and you're right. Like it does seem repeatable, not 37 matches in a row per se, but winning all these titles again, like it feels like she's already ticked off a lot of boxes and there's just, she's going at that rate, which is of those all time greats. And, it remains to be seen whether we'll see a rejuvenated Krejcikova is something that I find interesting. Krejcikova obviously went on that run after the US Open and she won Roland Garros last year, got to number two in the world and, was suffering from injuries all throughout the year and then finally hit her stride at the end of the next year. So that's probably another interesting storyline for me is the potential rivals of Swiatek. And I think Krejcikova probably has to be up there having beaten her in a final, for me, one of the best matches all year. The struggle final.
Last game especially. Go watch it if you haven't seen it.
And she's also proven herself as an all-court player. So I'm interested to see if that becomes a rivalry and hopefully. And I'm also interested to see if Sabalenka, Jabeur, Garcia, players like that, especially Garcia, the second half of the year that she had was really amazing as well. Winning in Cincinnati and winning the year-end championship and going deep at the US Open. And I think even though she got here 5 years ago, Garcia, and she's here now, I think having been through that whole experience and understanding how she needs to play, which is like, stepping in, taking the return super early, coming in, being aggressive and like sticking to that game plan and having confidence in it. Mm-hmm. I feel like she has a much better understanding of where she is as a player now.
Yeah.
But it's also going to be hard to sustain and see what she actually does at the Australian Open, because obviously this happened with Muguruza last year and Muguruza had one of the worst years this was probably her worst year ever. So it's tough to predict these kind of things, but I like where the women's game is headed because while Iga is super dominant, I feel like there are still players who can challenge her on different surfaces. And I still think it's going to be pretty competitive overall.
Yeah. So I agree with pretty much everything you said, but I also think the key word there that you said is challenge. Like as competitive as other players are, like, let's be honest, like Iga doesn't have a rival right now. Like Jabeur has had two shots at her in not two major finals, but US Open final, Rome final, and the second set of the US Open final was quite close, but like she wasn't really in either of the matches. Like she didn't have a lead. Krejcikova, that Ostrava final was incredible, but her peak is not what Swiatek's is. Sabalenka can maybe match her peak, but she has a much harder time finding it. So when she's off, which is a lot more of the time, it's difficult for her. I think Garcia looks great, but I think consistency is also a concern there. As of now, I think she could have a rival, but she doesn't at the moment. I agree with what you said. Like it's interesting because she is this dominant figure. And so it's not just, can she sustain her dominance? It's like, who could get in the way of that? And I think there are a few candidates, but no one jumps out clearly.
No one definitively. Yeah, that makes sense, especially because we just haven't seen, you know, more than two or three matches even between them in terms of like of great relevance. I guess you could say maybe Sabalenka and Iga have played, I think they played like 5 times this year and four of them were like not even very competitive. And really the US Open and the year-end championship were the two matches that made you think like, huh, this could get interesting. And I think she also beat her Iga last year in 2021. But, you know, it's, yeah, like, and I do think Sabalenka is one of those players who, yeah, like if she's in form and she's hot and she finds her game throughout the course of a tournament, she can be quite dangerous. But we also know she has some mental hiccups and obviously this sort of being a big challenge and kind of feels like she's been in the same place for a couple of years now as one of the best players to have not won a major. So
yeah,
it would be interesting to see who the other players who win a major are on the WTA next year, especially Wimbledon and the other one that Świątek, you know, doesn't win, or maybe
it's either one too. I agree. Wimbledon does feel pretty wide open. I mean, this year I thought Halep kind of had it with the form she was in, and then she got crushed by Rybakina. And then in the final, I thought Jabeur had it, and Rybakina came back and beat her too. Although I think Ons sort of suffered from some nerves. There's a big game where she had love 40 in the deciding set and didn't convert there. But yeah, that's the one I think that is momentarily safe from Świątek. You know, she might lose it one of the three others or even all of the three others, but like those are hers to win if she plays her best. And it feels like Wimbledon is kind of open.
Yeah. I also feel like there's so many wild cards on the WTA where, I mean, obviously we talked about Naomi, but I think, yeah, one of the other, my other takeaways from that match in Australia was like, oh, Naomi can do this again. Like she can put together a run like this.
Yeah.
And we saw it in Miami and I thought that was going to be a springboard for greater things to come. But unfortunately, you know, the motivation hasn't quite been there. The, you know, a lot of great things she's achieved already, like having won 4 majors, been number one, done a lot, but it's just difficult to see or difficult to predict how much more tennis she's going to play in her career and how badly she actually wants this, because it's just tough if you're not playing enough matches and you're not getting the reps and you're getting really tough draws like Danielle Collins in the first round of the US Open.
That was tough.
You know, players like that. So I just, it's kind of hard to predict, but I just feel like she's such a wild card. And because we've seen that she can do it and she's won 4 majors, you just have to always, I can never like count her out for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, her peak on hard court remains incredible, obviously. Like, so I think this was Miami, but it may have been Indian Wells. She played against Kerber earlier this year at one of those tournaments, I think.
Yeah.
And just, I thought it was going to be a great match. Sat down, watched the whole thing, wrote about it. I anticipated that I'd be writing about like an epic. And Osaka just destroyed her. Like, Kerber's a great defender, but she was defending constantly, and Osaka's shots were so heavy that you couldn't even really defend against them. Like maybe you get one back and then she just puts the next one away. And so you watch that and it's irresistible, really. Like there are no problems with her game. The serve is best in the world, probably. The forehand is massive. The backhand can be like erratic sometimes, but at its best, it's insane. Like remember, that match against Serena at the Australian Open last year, that 4-all game in the second, she just hits like 3 backhand winners. So it can catch fire like that. You know, the movement is not the best. Like she's still working out movement on clay, especially, but when you have ground strokes like that, like, you know, you don't need to be a super mover. But like you said, it's the motivation. Like if you don't, and I don't even really want to use the phrase, like if you don't want it badly enough, like if you're not prepared to get in the mindset of like, okay, I'm going to grind for 2 weeks. It's just not really going to happen. Like, I think we've seen that with Djokovic as well. Like there are no problems with his game, but when he's not engaged, he'll have these really weird losses. Like he looks slow. And it sort of seems like every part of his game will like suffer, because he's not mentally snapped into it. So I think that is a huge piece of it. I hesitate to make projections for the rest of her career just because like she's on the younger side too. But I'd certainly like to see her back.
She's 25, I believe. And she certainly, you know, if she wants it, there's still plenty of time left and there's still, And we know, like, you know, the women's game is deep, but her floor is also so high at her best on hard courts that you just can never, you can just never like rule out the possibility. And if she does call it, you know, if she does say, you know, I need a break or she needs some more time, it's like, I mean, can I really blame her? Like, she's won four majors. She's
done welcome everything. To the Hall of Fame, Naomi.
Yeah.
Like, great career. Like, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't think like I'm in a position to really, you know, judge her for that just because, you know, people are different and this life isn't for everyone. And she is kind of an introvert at heart. And, you know, it's just like she, the world is kind of her oyster. She can do whatever she wants at this point because, yeah, I mean, she's super rich. She makes so much money every single year based on endorsements. And she's marketable as heck because she's, you know, because of her background and because she's interesting and because, you know, she's in the world of pop culture as well as tennis. So I feel like there's so many avenues for her outside of the sport as well. But yeah. I feel like the longer she stays in tennis, it's just better for us. So
yeah,
better for the game.
Yeah. I mean, selfishly, I'd like to see her back, but from her perspective, like, who's to say tennis is better than any of these other options that she has. So yeah. That was a long side tangent. Going back to the Australian Open.
I guess now we're just going to cover the rest of the WTA while we're at it. But I was just going to say, like, you know, there are some other wild cards, right? Like you have Andreescu, for example. Right. So many losses this year to the eventual winner or to the eventual, like, you know, a few encouraging moments. Mm-hmm. But she never really got it, you know? It's one of those, like, I think she got to the final of Bad Homburg. She made, like, I think she played that really tight match against Swiatek in Rome. Like,
well,
one
first
tie break.
At least. Like, that first set was like, okay, she's so
one tie break and then a bagel, I think. And then I think Wimbledon, she lost to Rybakina. Rybakina ended up winning the whole thing.
Right.
Round two, I think. And then I think US Open, she lost to Garcia in the third round. Like, I watched her in San Diego. She lost to Coco Gauff. But it was, like, a really tight loss. Pretty encouraging. And there's just, like, some of these moments. But she's not the same player she was in 2019. And it's taking a little bit longer. And, you know, fitness is always still a concern. But she is definitely one of those players. You feel like if she puts together a good 6 month stretch of consistent results, the one big breakthrough will come.
Yeah. I mean, I think her main thing is just, like, if she stays healthy, great things will happen because her game is awesome. I think the only other thing is, like, avoid unnecessary three setters when possible. I think she gets dragged into wars by slugfests by a lot of players who she has the game to beat, like 2-2 or 2-4. And maybe that contributes to injury issues because spending so much time on court. That US Open match against Sakkari comes to mind. Not saying she
should have
put that one away necessarily, but that was just brutal. And it ended with her gassing out physically. Although that's also partly because Sakkari is a beast. But another match I was just thinking of, do you remember Halep Cornet at the Australian Open when it was so hot that Halep was literally stopping during rallies? Like, she was, like, walking during rallies. It was insane. And she almost still pulled it out. I thought she was going to. But that was a great match.
Yeah, I thought so as well. And that was a great moment for Cornet because she had never been in a...
Yeah.
I think she'd thought about retiring the year before and she'd never made a major quarterfinal. And it was always her goal in, like, 63 attempts. And she gave this, like, awesome on-court speech afterwards. I remember watching the end of that match. So physical, like you said. Both players were just, you know, dead on their legs.
Yeah.
And... yeah, like just such a war of attrition and some really good quality tennis in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was amazing at the Australian Open and then also Danielle Collins' run to the final.
Yeah.
Because she had some really tough matches in there, I remember, against, I want to say one of them was against Clara Tauson and the other against Elise Burton. Like those third and fourth round matches, she was down like a set and a break. Mm-hmm. And like she pulled those out and then she beats Cornet in the quarters. And then, of course, she plays the perfect match, best match of her career against Swiatek in the semis.
I mean, that will probably be the last time Swiatek gets demolished in a major like that for like 5 years. Like,
yeah,
I mean, not on grass. I don't have the exact stats, but I think I remember seeing a stat that Collins didn't miss a single second serve return in that match. And she was hitting winners, return winners constantly. It was insane.
Yeah, and of course, I just love her bravado and confidence on the court. She walks up there believing like she can beat anyone. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, she plays that way as well. And like she's been to an Australian Open semi, Australian Open final, I think Roland Garros quarters. Like she's got a really like I think she's one of those flute players who can take like weeks off at a time because of her health, because she's going through endometriosis and like, yeah, she has the health issues like on and off. I remember after Wimbledon, she took like a long time off and then just comes out and beats Osaka at the US Open and makes the fourth round. It's like she played maybe 10 or 11 tournaments, but she still finished like inside the top 15. So I feel like, yeah, with like somewhat of a more, like depending on her schedule, like I feel like she's so good that, especially on hard courts now, that she's like definitely still in the conversation for making deep runs.
Yeah, her confidence really impresses me too. Like I remember after the Australian Open final, she was pissed. Like in that way where it's sort of impressive, because it's like you weren't supposed to win this match, but like you're still pissed that you lost it and you felt like you should have won. Like, because that speaks to what players think their own potential is, I think. And when they sort of believe they should have won matches that like they weren't favored to win, I think that's very impressive, because it like they don't put self-imposed limits on themselves. And so I think like if she gets more opportunities to play in like big finals like that, she might get outplayed by a better player, but she won't beat herself. And I think that is not the case for everyone.
Yeah. I think she also has arthritis, which is like, so she has like arthritis plus endometriosis. So it's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah.
She's able to do this. Like it's, yeah, that must not be easy.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, yeah, her Australian Open run still impresses me. I'm impressed that she just got ahead 5-1 in a set against Barty, because that was more than anyone else was doing.
Yeah, like, so yeah, that kind of stood out about the Australian Open. And yeah, we mentioned Krejcikova already. I mean, I guess there's just some other players who showed like really good flashes of brilliance early on in the 2020s, like Mukova and Brady. I'm waiting for those two to.
I miss Brady a lot.
Get some matches.
Her.
Yeah, Brady has been gone for a long time now with a foot problem.
Yeah, when she had those matches against Osaka at the 2020 US Open and the Australian Open last year, so late in the tournament, playing at such a high level. I mean, she was a top player on hard court. Like, she was tier one. Yeah. So yeah, I'd love to see her back.
Yeah, and then same with Sophia Kennan, who won the Australian Open in 2020, made the French Open final as well.
It's a long road back for her.
Long road back.
Like, she's completely fallen off the map.
Yeah. But yeah, and then of course now you also have players, and then you also have players kind of stuck in their positions, if you like, still really high ranked, you know, players like Sakkari and Pegula. Pegula obviously having the year of her life, getting to world number three and losing to Iga three times. I mean, losing to Iga twice in majors and then Barty in Australia.
Yeah.
And she was a consistent performer, consistently getting to quarters and semis. And I was happy for her when she won Guadalajara, which was a 1,000 at the end of the year. And she beat four major champions and then beat Sakkari in the final. But yeah, Sakkari is another one of those. Obviously, she had disappointing slam results, but she finished off the year really on a nice note, you know, getting to the semis of the year and championship. And yeah, just lost a lot of finals, like four finals this year, Indian Wells final, Guadalajara final. So you feel like the level is still there. She's a top eight player, but just closing through in those big matches, it seems very mental with Sakkari.
Yeah, I really think it will happen for her at some point, but I think that point may still be like a long way off, because this pattern of beating herself in big matches at the end of tournaments is so defined by now. I mean, her game is so good. Like, there are no problems with her game. Like, the serve is great.
Yeah,
she's so fit, like strong on both forehand and backhand. You know, obviously there are like a few things she could do better. Like, I think she played Iga in the Indian Wells final.
Yeah,
I thought Świątek sort of exposed the lack of margin on some of her ground strokes in that one.
Particularly her forehand, she likes to hit big from the backhand side, inside out and inside in, and sometimes she doesn't quite give herself enough margin, or sometimes she's super physical. She's such a great athlete. So you feel like, yeah, with her movement and her athleticism, she sometimes tries to pull off too ambitious of shots on some occasions, or tries to cut down the rallies. It seems very sort of, she seems to sort of get in her head in that way. And yeah. once she just relaxes and plays very freely, like when she's down to the score, then she becomes super dangerous, I feel like. She's one of the best when it comes to like saving break points, ironically.
Yeah, and didn't she have a match against Pegula in Miami last year where she saved like 6 match points with winners or something?
Yeah, and they were all with winners. And they were, you know, some of them were hitting the lines and some of them were just bold shots. But it's usually when she has leads or when she believes that she can win the title, that's when it sort of creeps up in her head. Yeah. And it feels like psychologically and that kind of affects some of her timing and technique. Yeah. And it feels like kind of interrelated, but
I think
the game is there, like no doubt. Like, she did make 2 major semis last year and nearly won the French Open, so.
Right, yeah. I mean, yeah, I really do think it'll happen at some point for Sakkari. Like, I think she'll win big titles.
I hope so. I mean, there's quite a bit of scar tissue there, but you would hope, you would think with that kind of game, you know, at least she gets any kind of a title. That's pretty much all she's missing because she has only 1 career title, I think, and like 6 finals, multiple semis. Like, it's... At this point, I think it's, like she goes into these matches knowing these stats and it's obviously tough to block that out, but all it takes is just 1. I mean, we saw what happened with Felix this year, but yeah, I think that's about it, especially from Roland Garros. I remember on the women's side, it was obviously a player that we have to talk about is Yangxin Wen, right? Because she pushed Iga the furthest at the French Open, took that first set in a tiebreak.
Yeah.
And then was a bit physically compromised for the next 2 sets. But really, she kind of set the tone this year that like, hey, I'm going to be like the breakout player and watch out for 2023 because, you know, I'm inside the top 30 and I've got a bright future. And she seems to do everything pretty well. She's pretty well-rounded. I would say her game is pretty complete. I mean, obviously there's still things to work on, but I like her mentality and she seems quite composed and calm and like I don't really see a whole lot there that's I think she can honestly get to the top 5 in the world and potentially challenge for these majors.
Yeah, I mean her game is sort of uniquely capable of matching Świątek from the baseline, I think, because her ground strokes have that same weight to them. And she's also like willing to use that drop shot to keep her opponents guessing. And so it's hard to position yourself perfectly. And if you compare that sort of the other players that Świątek beat at Roland Garros, like, you know, I mean, and these are great players, but like Kasatkina in the semis and Goff in the final had like nothing to hurt Świątek with because they either didn't have enough power. And so they would just get like overpowered from a certain wing or they would have an inconsistent shot. And then Iga would force errors. And and that is not the case in this matchup. Like that, it's not just that she won the set, but she was sort of capable of like matching Świątek throughout winning some of these toe-to-toe rallies, which I think is, I mean, other players can't do that. Świątek is just sort of all-conquering from the baseline. So yeah, I think she's got a very high ceiling.
I love her backhand as well. Like I remember her really matching Świątek for that shot and picking the right one to go down the line. And yeah, like, I mean, she moves pretty well. She's got a pretty good serve as well. So it seems to all kind of be there. Now it's just a matter of putting it all together consistently. And she did show quite a bit of consistency this year too. So it feels pretty safe to think that she'll be ranked a lot higher than she is right now.
Yeah, I think so.
But and then obviously you have players like Ludmila Samsonova, you know, made like deep runs, won titles, like got to the 4th round. I think she has one of the best forehands in the game as well. So it also feels like her game also feels pretty legit. She's also another one of those like Yangxin Wen, obviously a lot older, but you know, around 20 in the world, you feel like she'll probably be ranked higher at some point next year, particularly that for her first half of the year was not that strong. Going back to Roland Garros, obviously you have Coco Gauff making the final there and, you know, having an overall pretty good year, US Open quarters as well, quite a lot of quarterfinals, no titles, but you felt like she improved this year.
Yeah.
Her year didn't end very well with the WTA finals, but kind of understandable for an 18-year-old because this was the first year she could play so many matches with the age eligibility restrictions.
Yeah. And by the end of the year, like, physically and mentally fried. I think like really the only thing in her way right now because like I think she's improved a lot. I think she's a great game. She's athletic, great backhand, serve, return, I think are very strong. Beforehand, I think is shaky, but has a lot of time to improve. I think the worst thing is that she matches up terribly with Swiatek, who...
And that's because of the forehand.
She's going to run into constantly. I mean, if... So they played four times this year. And so in Miami, Swiatek won 6-3, 6-1. In Roland Garros, 6-1, 6-3. San Diego, 6-0, 6-3. And WTA Finals, 6-3, 6-0. It's very hard to take a positive from that, from golf's perspective. I mean, she is younger than Swiatek, I think. She has a ton of time to improve all of these things. But I think as of now, like, that's going to be a very, very difficult matchup to handle.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, she's not really coming close in any of these matches. And, like, none of them have been... there was not even a flicker of hope in really any of them. And I feel like the forehand... Yeah, technically, it's a little bit of a flawed shot, in my opinion. Because she kind of... Like, if you watch her hit it, you know, there's times where she's... against, you know, players that she should be beating, where she's really stepping in and taking it early on the rise and following it to net. And I like that kind of play from her. But then there's other times where she's kind of falling back, hitting it on her back foot, kind of hitting it, taking it late, like hitting it really loopy, like the take back is too long. And you just feel like there's too many, there's maybe a technical way for her to improve that shot, but it's just, you know, and it would involve like changing the swing path or tinkering with that at such a young age. And her, the rest of her game is so darn good. That it can sometimes make up for it and hide it, especially on clay. But it's just, I don't know, to win a major, like I feel like if she improves her forehand and just fixes a couple of things, she can win a slam. I just don't think it'll come next year. I think maybe in 2024, but I would say next year she gets to like a couple of semis, stays in the top five, keeps getting some big runs, hopefully wins a couple of titles or something. That would probably qualify as a good year. But yeah, she's kind of in that like middle phase right now where it's just where it's gonna be more or less the same unless that one thing gets better, right?
Yeah, I mean I think a major title isn't out of the question if she doesn't have to play Swiatek, really, because I mean she did make a final at 18 years old. That's amazing. You know, I think it's just like certain matchups like that are gonna prove tough, but you know, with so much time on her side, like, I think she will win multiple majors.
And as far as her future is concerned, the stock is super high. So it's just like immediate short-term thinking right now.
Yeah. I mean, she's 3 years younger than Swiatek. Like, that is a lot, especially at this age. Like, if it's a 24-year-old and a 27-year-old, it's like, okay, the 24-year-old has had, like, several solid years on tour. And Goff has had a few years on tour because her breakout was so early. But she's still got so much time. I mean, she's got... at the very least, like another solid decade of like prime years if she chooses to play that long and stays healthy.
Yeah, of course. And of course, on the WTA, before we, you know, start to shift things a little bit, I do have to mention Alicia Parks because she's been on a tear since the US Open. Obviously more at challenger level, like WTA 125s. She's won a couple of them. I also watched her in Ostrava where she qualified and then she beat Pliskova and Sakkari. I thought her game is quite impressive. She has a really big serve, moves pretty well, pretty dynamic athlete, covers the court well, you know, extremely versatile, likes to come to the net. You know, she will have some matches where it goes off the boil and it doesn't look very good. But then there's other times where if she's fully locked in and she's, I think, 21, 22, she just has a lot of confidence and momentum right now. Mm-hmm. Going into the next season in the WTA landscape, I think that's pretty valuable. Especially if we've seen players like Andreescu in the past in 2018, she went on a similar run like this and then, you know, ends up winning Indian Wells and ends up doing all these great things. I'm projecting that Alicia Parks will do the same, but obviously there just have been examples of this in the past where players have this amazing rare thing at the challengers. And then it just kind of, because they're so new and because they're in that honeymoon phase, it's just so hard for the established top players to sort of game plan against them. Right. And so I feel like she could come out of the gates in 2023, maybe not directly in Australia, but I feel like potentially at some point in the hardcore events during the year, I could see her doing some real damage. She's at 75 in the world right now. So her ranking jumped up like 60 spots in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. So she's kind of like, I guess if you want to make an ATP comparison, like the Ben Shelton of the ATP right now. So it's like, those are just a couple of players to watch out for.
I haven't really gotten a chance to see her play, but I'm excited to follow her in 2023. You know, ranking of 75, that means main draws at majors. So, like, opportunities to maybe make a couple more high profile runs. She'll have a ton of momentum, kind of like you said. Seeing on her page that she's 6'1", so I think
ideal size.
Yeah, for the serve to get incredibly good. I'm excited to watch her in the future.
That's right. And the serve is quite a weapon, like especially on those indoor courts. I was watching her in Ostrava. She ended up losing to Krejcikova, who ended up winning the title and gave her a pretty good second set. But it was those two consecutive matches against Pliskova and Sakkari that made me think, oh, okay, that's not a fluke. This is something she can actually put this together. So it will be interesting to see. I mean, it's hard to predict, but and then going back to the French Open, I had Leila Fernandez as well was one of my stories because she unfortunately was out for a long time and had to miss Wimbledon after that run, but she ended up beating Bencic and Anisimova along the way, and she played that 3-set match against Trevisan, and
with like a broken bone.
It was like very impressive because even though she lost that match, she just refused to give up. And in hindsight, it might have been better if she had retired in that match because
it would have been. But I get what you're saying. Like I was in the stands for a part of that, and I mean, she's got that insanely rare quality. Like she should have retired, but she didn't. And even with that massive injury, it was close. Like I think she was down to a double break, and she got one back, and then she got to 15-30 when Trevisan was trying to serve it out. Like she was still in that match. And, you know, I don't recommend playing through injury. I wish she hadn't done it. I wish Nadal hadn't done it at Wimbledon. But, I mean, her drive is nearly unmatched. I think she's got another very, very rare quality where she can play. It's sort of like what Djokovic has on match points, I think. Like, I think certain pressure situations, match points, like, she's got something that other players don't. She can play like the score doesn't matter. And I think her game is really unique. Like she's one of the best timers, ball strikers. She can take the ball early. She's one of the players I'm most excited to follow in the coming like half decade plus.
Yeah, and I also do feel like that definitely interrupted her season, and I think she finished 40 in the world. But if I actually really look at her results, I mean, she won a title in Monterey. Her win percentage was not awful considering it was her first year after making a major final. And it's a little bit, like, I guess it's kind of misleading and it's kind of tempting to put her in the same camp as Raducanu. But if I actually look at her year, she had some good moments. Like, and even at the US Open, I remember she lost the second round, but she almost won that second set against, what was it, Samsonova, I think? Yeah, Samsonova. Samsonova was on like a 13 match win streak at the time. So I felt like that was probably expected. But nonetheless, I think, Fernandez is so young as well. I think she's even younger than Świątek, so she's got a lot of time. And I wouldn't be surprised to see her in the top 20 at some next year because assuming she's healthy and she's able to play a good schedule. But
I don't know if she's totally ready to threaten for big titles regularly yet, but like I wouldn't be surprised if we saw her in the semis of a major or threatening for a big title at some point.
Because the way she was looking in Paris, I mean, she pulls out that Trevisan match. That golf match is kind of up in the air, and potentially she's in the major final. Right. Probably wasn't gonna beat Świątek, but nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, but I think on the whole, though, like you know, there are a lot of players who can play it at an incredibly high level, but Świątek is doing it by far the most consistently, and so I think there are candidates for a rival for her in 2023. But right now, it's Świątek and then everyone else.
And then there's just so many good players that I look at them like, how have you not done better? But then it's like, oh yeah, that's why, because all these other great players too. It's like, I think of like Belinda Bencic, like amazing, you know, like 2019 makes the US Open semis, like plays that awesome match against Andreescu, like, you know, Olympic gold medalist, like wins titles, like has her really good weeks. And then I watch her in those really good weeks and I'm just like, how have you not been past, you know, how have you not been past like the fourth round of like Wimbledon yet, or like of the Australian Open, and it's like, or even Roland Garros, it's like, it seems like kind of low hanging fruit, but then you actually look at the draws and you're like, oh yeah, yeah,
Yeah, like you, the you have to play like that consistently, like every match sometimes, yeah, if you're going to get through some of the draws. I mean, and yeah, like, I mean, remember when Radu Kanu had that random like 2 or 3 match hot streak in Cincinnati, and it was like, wait, is she back? Like,
yeah, I thought so. Although Azarenka and Serena were way off their games.
But it just shows
like the level is still there. Like, I mean, she played a really good match against Stephens in the first round of Australian Open. Mm-hmm. And I think people, she won that first round, and then I think she got injured in the second round against Kovanich. Like, she had some blister.
She had to like slice her forehand.
But I was like, that was impressive, because it's like, you know, you could have lost like 6-4, 6-1, but you like tried to win, believed you could win, and didn't come through in the end. But like, you learned a lot about yourself.
Yeah.
And I also thought her clay season was like pretty decent. Like, she won quite a few matches, like 5 or 6, and she played Swiatek like pretty decently in Stuttgart. It was like 4-4.
Yeah,
there were like some flashes. Mm-hmm. And then I think towards the end of the year, she made a semi and won 3 matches in a row for the first time all year, and then was up a set on Ostapenko and then retired. So it's like, yeah, I think she had a lot of fitness issues as well. Like, it was just tough to forget about, like, you know, all the off-court stuff and the expectations and all of that from the public. But it's just like, just playing week in and week out was just something she was never used to, because
I think in a lot of ways, the farther away that US Open title gets, the easier her path on tour will be. Just because that pressure will gradually go away. She'll get more experience. I mean, I think this year could be more productive for her than last year was. Because it is much more typical of like a year on tour rather than sort of one like massive bright flash at the end.
Yeah, and it was encouraging to see that she is working with Jez Green, you know, who is Andy Murray's fitness trainer, and so many countless of other players. So it's great to see that. I mean, I hope she keeps, like, she has that stability with the coaching situation and all of that. Like, they're trying some new things with, like, different coaches for each stroke. And, you know, like, once she got rid of the coach that she won the US Open with, there was already kind of signs of trouble.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, I still think I wouldn't rule out, like, you know, her finishing between 25 and 40 next year in the rankings.
Definitely.
And maybe even winning a title at a 250 level, or making a deep, maybe getting to a second week of a slam or something like that. I still feel like it'll be much more of like you said, like a typical 25 through 50 kind of year.
Yeah.
I think.
So to kind of round out this segment, because we're on pace to have like a 2-hour podcast.
Yeah, you're right.
Or hour and a half or something. I don't want to do like full predictions for next year, but sort of, what do you think is going to happen with Swiatek? Like, what are your predictions for her? How much is she going to win? How is the rest of the field going to do in terms of challenging her?
So I feel like, because she has such a massive lead in the points, and she has like twice as much as Jabeur, and she's won all of these things, she does have a lot to defend, but she also has some... But I also feel confident in her defending a lot of it. So I feel like she's going to win at least a major, likely 2. I think I might even go with 2, just because I feel that safe about her right now. Mm-hmm. I think she might win 2 majors. I think she'll probably win 1 of the Indian Wells or Miami. Probably win Rome. She probably wins another hardcourt 1000. It's like, I see a similar kind of year, maybe not as dominant, but a year pretty similar. You know, kind of like a, like if Iga's year this year was like a Djokovic 2011, maybe she has a Djokovic 2012.
Like, I was just thinking that exact same thing.
Like,
so like, still number one, just not quite as dominant.
Yeah, I still think she'll finish the year number one. I don't see anyone else doing it, really.
Yeah, I think she'll be number one for all of next year, honestly. And I sort of agree with you. Like, I'm going to say 2 majors. Like, I think she gets Australia and then probably Roland Garros again. I think she could win 3 even. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if she got everything except Wimbledon. I also wouldn't be surprised if someone took her out in Australia, or she only won 1 major, only in quotes. But like, I think 3 is certainly on the table.
And then who do you think is going to win? Do you think any of Jabeur, Sabalenka, or Garcia, or Sakkari is going to win a major? One of those 4? Or Krejcikova? I'll throw Krejcikova in there as well.
This is so hard to predict, because it's kind of contingent on, like, do they have to play Iga? I think if they do, I kind of feel best about Sabalenka's chances just because I think she's the most capable of redlining and winning. But then on the flip side, she's probably the least likely to win seven matches in a row in terms of the consistency of her game. I think Sabalenka and Garcia, I think, could do it, maybe. I think Jabeur is probably a better player, but it's less likely to beat Swiatek head-to-head. It's really tough to say. I honestly think the main deciding factor is going to be like, where does Iga lose? And then who is going to be best positioned to swoop in after that? I wouldn't back any of these players to beat her in a major final.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I could see a situation where we have Jabeur, Sabalenka, Krejcikova doing really well at Wimbledon and getting far in the tournament. I don't know who's going to, you know, I can't really say. Like, it's very much draw dependent, but I do see Iga winning two slams, I think.
I think Krejcikova could get one. I think her game is reliable in a way that maybe some others aren't. I think
she's good about her. Yeah,
like, I feel like she can go toe-to-toe with Iga. Like, not overpower her, go toe-to-toe with her. And that could be helpful. She can use the angles. I don't know. It's really tough to say.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then, of course, yeah, the way Swiatek won the US Open was just incredible. Like, you know, not playing her best, but coming through in those really big moments. And
yeah.
I think that's what really solidified it for me. But I think that's pretty much it for the women's game.
Yeah. Sorry if we missed some of the good matches at Wimbledon, but I think holistically we covered a lot of it.
I think at Wimbledon, I mean, some of the best matches, Tan and Serena.
Yeah.
That has to be up there for sure. I thought that the match between, I think, was it Niemeyer in the quarters?
I don't remember, honestly.
Yeah, like Niemeyer, I think, was involved in it. Like, there was some good matches in the quarters of that tournament, I want to say. I think it was, was it Niemeyer and Pliskova or something? No, I don't think it was that.
Wimbledon, I followed the least this year.
Yeah,
same. I didn't even watch a lot.
I was actually in India when this was happening, and I couldn't catch. I had a blind spot for this part of the tournament, but some cool stories. Oh, yeah, it was Maria. It was Tatiana Maria. Yeah, that's what it was. But yeah, that was, Wimbledon, I don't think, I guess the final was pretty decent.
Yeah, had drama for sure.
Knock it out. And then of course, US Open, we had the Sabalenka Iga semifinal. So that,
yeah, Sabalenka being up 4-2 in the third, that was. Those last four games were wild, and sort of her suffering a really tough semifinal defeat at the US Open for the second year in a row. Very similar loss to Fernandez in 2021. Do you want to move on to the ATP?
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. I have to eat dinner, so I probably have less time for this. But the first ATP match that came to mind for me when you asked that initial question was actually Alcaraz Berrettini. In the third round. And while Alcaraz didn't win that, I feel like in a way it was sort of prophetic of how the rest of the year was going to go, because he showed off so many impressive signs in that match where it was like, even though he lost, it was like, he's coming for everyone.
Yeah, sure. That definitely foreshadowed everything, because he was 2 sets above down, and the way Alcaraz really turned that match and was by far the better player for sets 3 and 4 and even a lot of set 5 until the tiebreak. Yeah, and then I guess Berrettini showed off like the impressive forehand and serve and the reliability that he has in majors to, you know, and in the clutch moments, he didn't make a single unforced error in that tiebreak, and probably I would say his best win so far in a major at that point.
And the one he was going to a major as well was good, because that one he was up 2 sets as well and had to win it in 5.
Yeah, so I think, and even though Alcaraz lost in the first 3 majors of the year, I mean, those 3 players played some of the best matches, like the best match of their life in a major to beat him. Yeah. So I think that's, and then like you said, it did spark off that incredible run, especially from Rio and Indian Wells and Miami. I mean, he should get a trophy alone for winning that 2nd set against Nadal in the wind in Indian Wells.
That was nuts. That was a very good match for a lot of the time. And Nadal hitting all those volleys in the 3rd set from like reflex positions. That one was fun. I really think that was the best stretch of the year overall, during Swiatek's win streak and Alcaraz's kind of
at the same time
stretch. Because they were both like so electrifying in the highlight reels. Alcaraz was really the face of a lot of that first half of the year for me. I mean, you had Nadal.
Alcaraz and Nadal as well.
I mean, like Nadal, obviously, because he won the 2 majors, but sort of in that stretch between that, with Alcaraz winning Miami and Madrid, it was really like, okay, he's gotten here a lot faster than I thought.
Yeah. Not to go on a tangent here, but that was also a really good advocate for why these exhibitions really don't mean much in the larger scheme of things, because Nadal played those exhibitions, didn't do well, then lost to Andy Murray, lost to Shapovalov, then goes on a great match winning streak, and he gets COVID right after.
He lost to Andy Murray. I forgot about that.
It was in that exhibition and whatever they play in Abu Dhabi, or I think is where it was. Yeah, and then he just goes on this 20-match win streak. And, you know, most people still didn't think he was going to win AO. Right. One, because of the draw. Obviously, you had the uncertainty about Novak not being there, but they still put Medvedev ahead of him. They still thought Zverev was going to beat him. They still thought, those 3 matches in the ATP 250 were not going to be enough. Yeah. They thought Shapovalov had him after he won the 4th set.
He had a heat stroke. It looks tricky for a little bit in the 4th set.
And then so he had that. And then in the final, no chance, you know. Yeah. 2 sets to love down, 2-3 love 40. We all know what happens.
Right.
But it's like, just the improbability of it all. Combined with all the Djokovic fiasco that happened before, it's just, you couldn't script it. Like, it was one of those stories that you just, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, they should really make like a movie out of it, or the Australian Open YouTube channel should do like a hour-long feature on it. I rewatched the whole final and basically summarized every point for Popcorn Tennis. So if you want to read my thoughts on it, you can go there. But something I came across when watching the match is that now famous like 4% thing of the win predictor. That actually came early in the 3rd set. Like, I think after the 1st game, when Medvedev held after saving a break point. So that means it would have been even lower at 2-3 love 40, like probably 2%, 1% at that point. The amount of ground he had to make up to win that match is insane. And kind of conversely, like, it's become emblematic of Medvedev's year, really. That was as good as it got for him.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and then of course, you know, you had the Indian Wells run to the final. He was on that 20-match win streak. I think he was down and out against Korda, like 5-2 down in the 3rd set.
That's right, yeah.
Break. Somehow survived that.
Yeah.
Like, somehow survived those matches against Kyrgios in the quarters, Alcaraz in semi. It was just, it was the best start he's ever had in the history of his career from a statistical standpoint, winning 20 matches in a row.
You know, as bad as you can feel for, like, one of the best ever with hundreds of millions of dollars in prize money, I did feel bad for him that he didn't get Indian Wells, because it was a very impressive run to the final. And then, you know, he didn't make a huge deal of it at first, but then I think he said in an interview it felt like he's getting stabbed by needles in the midsection when
he was in quite a lot of pain, particularly towards the end of that match. And he still I still think Fritz had to show a lot of gumption though to win it, because he himself was not feeling his best.
Second
he also had
tough.
His ankle He also had his ankle numbed before the final and then ended up having to pull out of the entire clay stretch. So that match was strange because they were both struggling physically, yet, you know, Fritz Nadal was struggling a lot more physically, it looked like, than Fritz was. But it still felt like, you know, such a big match because then they would go on and they'd play at Wimbledon.
With
the fifth set tiebreak and Nadal having the injury there, and then it was like, and then they met again at the end of the year. But so that's one of those matches now where I'm curious to see where that rivalry, I guess, takes us next year, because it's now has two wins.
It'd be great to see them play at the Australian Open, really. I think that could be a really fun quarterfinal. Maybe even a semifinal. But yeah, I think sort of a sneaky part of Nadal's winning streak that I think was up there with like his most impressive moments was that semifinal with Medvedev and Acapulco. Which he won 6-3, 6-3, but he had to save all 11 break points he faced. In the second set, there was a stretch where Medvedev was holding easily, and Nadal at 1-2 saves 4 break points, and then at 2-3 saves 7 break points. And there was a stat at one point where like Medvedev had played 13 points on serve in that set, and Nadal had played like 30. And I think at one point he had played like 50 points on serve. I know there was a 20 point game, but he got the holds, and then he was already up a break when he played those games, but he got those holds. And then in the last game, he broke from 40 love down. And so when he won that felt very emphatic because Medvedev was number one at the time, first meeting, only meeting since their Australian Open final. When he did that, I was like, he's already had a good year, but he's going to have a good year.
Right. Yeah, that was maybe level-wise his best tournament. Now that I think about it, like from start to finish. I mean, obviously not the same level of opposition as like from Medvedev, but still a pretty big, emphatic statement, I guess, to the rest of the tour. But yeah, and then I mean, it was marred by injuries as well. I mean, the match against Shapovalov in Rome. And before that, he still had those epic matches in Madrid, coming back from the rib injury against Goffin, where he saved points.
I feel like everyone's like forgotten about that one just because so much has happened. Like it was a big deal at the time, but like you just reminded me of it now. It's like, yeah, that happened. It's kind of interesting to see how the year has shaken out because, you know, Nadal definitely the face of the ATP that first half, winning both majors. And, you know, injuries had a big hand in this, but then the second half of the year, he really sort of fell away, and it was, and then other people like came to the fore. I feel like the second half of the year was much more Alcaraz and Djokovic.
It was kind of like a year of thirds. They all had their stretches of domination, and it was just, because Djokovic, obviously from Rome till the end of the year, was phenomenal. Like he won 5 titles and lost the one final to Rune in Paris. But apart from that, and the one Davis Cup match and the Roland Garros quarterfinal. But apart from that, it was pretty much his to lose. And then you also had the Alcaraz stretch until Wimbledon. And then you had the Nadal first half of the year. And then at the end, you had like Felix and Rune and all these other players, Rude as well, making his mark. It was like, so it was kind of like you could make a case this year for like either of those three being player of the year. And I probably would say, yeah, you probably have a good point. But just the fact that Nadal pulled 2 ahead and still leads the slam race, I think that's very significant because, you know, just him having won those 2 majors, it's like for the other two to have had a really strong argument, they would have to do like a lot more outside of that. But it was just the fact that he was able to win those 2, I think, is pretty big. And he did finish off his year with a win at the ATP Finals. And then I think we're not talking about the foot anymore. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
It's like at the end of the...
His treatment is working. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that seems to be working so far. It's still probably a concern because of his history and given everything in the back of his mind. And we still don't know how much longer he's going to play and all of that. What we do know is that if he could win the French Open this year, then, I mean, what's to say that he can't win it again next year? Like, I'm
exactly.
not...
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that has been the case since 2005. So,
right. And then just the fact that he still made the semis at Wimbledon, having not played on grass in 3 years, and that he won the Fritz match.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah.
I'm still mad about the whole way that unfolded. It sucks that he got hurt and he couldn't play the semi, because a Nadal Djokovic final there would have been amazing on many levels. And I want to sort of focus on Djokovic for a minute, because you said, like, since Rome, he's been phenomenal. And that's true. But it's really interesting to me how I think in arguably the most significant match he played this year, which is that match against Nadal at Roland Garros, he didn't quite have it.
He didn't have it. That's
true. And I think that's the first time he didn't have it in, like, a really big match. I mean, you know, you've got the U.S. Open final last year. But I think that one, he had the excuse of being physically and mentally fried. In this match, like, he had destroyed four opponents in straight sets. He was rested. He had just won Rome. Nadal had more on his legs. Like, Djokovic was actually favored. And he didn't really... I think he played well for a lot of the match, but I don't think it was, like, a typical Djokovic performance, like a lockdown performance. I think he probably still regrets that one.
Yeah, particularly the way the fourth set unfolded with the two set points that he had, particularly the way the fact that he gave Nadal such a big lead in the fourth set tiebreak, that he pretty much had to Hail Mary his way back to get to 6-4. And then, yeah, like, the first set, such a slow start. The second set, he had to red line. Third set was not good.
Yeah.
So it's like he had all these dips. And then, you know, I think the crowd also was bothering him, like the reception that he got when he first came on the court.
Right.
There were all these other factors. And I think at that point, I don't think his relationship with Nadal was really good at that point, because of just, like, you know, he didn't think that Nadal supported him in the whole Australia thing. That was weighing on his mind. It's just, you know, and then he knew the importance of that match, because if he wins that, you know, then yeah, the winner of that was pretty much essentially going to win that tournament, especially when Alcaraz lost. I still felt like, I mean, you never know, because Zverev was playing the best major he had played until that point, but it's still, but you still would have favored the winner of whoever won. And just, yeah, historically it was a pretty big match, but I still think, like, come again next year, usually by the time Rome comes around, Djokovic is still he's still right behind Nadal to win Roland Garros.
Yeah. It's just, I wouldn't rule out him winning.
It's just like, it was just kind of restored again from 2021, and Nadal showing that, like, yeah, you beat me last year, but this isn't the norm. Like, we played 10 times and I've beaten you 8 out of the 10.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, just the way that match unfolded was really interesting to me, because I think, like, the first set, you can say Djokovic started slow, but I don't think anyone ever was going to win that set against Nadal. And then the second set, he pulls out from 0-3, 15-30 double breakdown.
Yeah.
And then the third set, he just, like, wasn't really a factor. And I remember watching that, and it's like, you're going to let this set get away this easily and back yourself to beating it all at Roland Garros from two sets to one down? Like, really? Like, why are you doing this? Like, I thought it's sort of 2013 where he lost the third set of their semifinal there that year, 6-1. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, and he came back and almost won that one. But yeah, I don't know. I think for vital stretches of the match, he wasn't quite himself, and that was very costly. So I, even though they've played there a lot and they haven't really played on hard court, I want to see them play again there next year. Just because every match they play there is different. And it's all interesting to me, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and still, like, the level in that match was still probably good enough to be a top five match of this year. So it was, I mean, like, it was still better than, you know, you'd still probably rate it higher than even the fourth round, even though Rafa did get pushed to the fifth set. I felt like the fifth set of that match was amazing, but
yeah, it was so
but it was a very different type of match, in that it was much more on the Felix serve plus one and kind of maneuvering Nadal around, and Nadal had his dips in that, but then the way he finished in that fifth set really carried over, I think, into the Djokovic match. He really felt good about how he needed to play. But he's felt that way in all three of their last Roland Garros meetings. He's always come off to a really quick start.
Yeah.
And I think Novak can't allow that to happen the next time they play, because he did it once in 2021, but it's just it's just not sustainable. You know, you have to redline to get your way back.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that it's, you know, he can't really afford losing the first set, but at the same time, like, does he have a choice? Like, I mean, you look at Nadal's level in those sets and it's like, what are you really going to do? Like, redlining perfectly out of the gates, I guess, but that's so hard to do. Like, just not feeling any nerves.
Yeah, for sure. And so Nadal goes on, wins the title very comfortably over Casper Ruud. who, you know, in his own right, he had a he made the French Open final, had a great breakthrough, played some good matches against Rune and Cilic, and you know, got past the third round, which is a big hurdle for him. And I'm thinking about it now, he didn't even have a good clay season until Rome, because he got to the semis of Rome and then he won Geneva and then he made the French Open final. But before that, it was really kind of mediocre. Like, he didn't have any good results until Rome.
Until Roland Garros, wasn't he down 2-1 at some point?
He was,
like, in the early round.
Yeah, in the third round against Sonego, he was down 2-1.
Right.
But he got out of that, and then I think he had a four setter with Hurkacz. Oh yeah, in the first round he also retired Sanga. I forgot about that
so easily.
Yeah, he beat Hurkacz. Even though Hurkacz was up a break in the fourth, and you still felt like Rude had a decent chance to get this.
Yeah, I remember a lot from that match. Basically, Rude wins the first two sets like he's playing a junior, and then in the third set, Hurkacz wins a highlight reel point. Crowd goes crazy. He gets a set out of it, and then once Rude recovered in the fourth, that was that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Casper Ruud is going to be interesting for me next year because he didn't play the Australian Open.
Yeah.
He didn't really have a preseason.
He's probably world number one after the Australian Open, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm thinking. But then it's like, yeah, like, he has to have a really good result in Australia, probably has to have a really good result at Indian Wells, probably has to defend most of his Miami points. But then after that, his clay stretch was kind of mediocre until Rome. So then it's like, and then, you know, yeah, and even after the US Open, I guess, is in another spot in his calendar and on grass. But, like, so as good as he was this year with those big runs, he kind of had moments where he lost a few matches in a row, or he wasn't, you know, he kind of went in and out for a bit. But, like, yeah, I mean, he has a decent chance, just math-wise and points-wise, along with Djokovic, of course.
Yeah, I think this sort of segues nicely into the Australian Open because you know, Ruud didn't play. Alcaraz lost early, so he can pick up points too. He's already world number one. Djokovic didn't play. Like, is Djokovic, you know, Nadal's defending champion, is Djokovic going to win the Australian Open? Like, because I think he is a big, pretty big favorite. Like, I think if he plays his best, no one can beat him. But I don't know whether he'll play his best. And I also wonder if, like, an Alcaraz Medvedev 1-2 could take him out.
Yeah, you do wonder about sort of the cumulative effect that these best of five matches have on Djokovic at this point in his career, right? Just because, I mean, let's say he gets like a really tough fourth round, and then a really tough, then he gets like, you know, a Medvedev in his quarterfinal, or like a Alcaraz, and then he gets like, like, if he has an Alcaraz Medvedev combo, like you were saying, or he has a really tough fourth round, and, like, it could be like the wear and tear of the fourth round, quarters, semis, and then maybe he has a day. Doesn't have, like, he has a really long extended semi. Like, I'm still kind of curious to see whether he still has it in him completely physically after these long breaks. Like, you still have to prove it again. He is the favorite just because he's never lost a semi, never lost a final. He's won this thing 9 times. And he looks like the best player in the world right now. But nothing is for certain right now. And he does have, you know, a decent amount of challengers, like more than Świątek does, I would say. Like, it's, you know, at this point, maybe Wimbledon is the one that's the safest for Djokovic
to win. I think
he's probably more likely to win. I put up a poll, and 70% of the people said he's more likely to win Wimbledon than it is to win Roland Garros, just because of the number of contenders.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Wimbledon, he's won 4 in a row now. And, you know, 2018, 2019, he was very close to losing. And I guess this year as well, is down 2 sets to Sinner. But besides those moments, it's all felt very comfortable.
Yeah, so I think he is a favorite, but, you know, like, I can't say, like, 100%. Like, it's not like a shoo-in.
Yeah, I'm excited to see his draw, because if it's, like, Medvedev in the quarters and Alcaraz in the semis, I don't know. Like, that could be, I think Alcaraz...
Or like a Sinner or Rune in the fourth round, or like a Kyrgios in the third round. Like, it doesn't seem like it's like there could be tough bats there.
Yeah. This is reminding me of like my Djokovic hater days. I'd be like, okay, I hope the draw is bad like every round. And then I'd look at it and be like, oh, he's going to destroy everyone.
Yeah. But then I also like, then he also just has those random moments where in the fourth round, like in 2016, he goes 5 sets against Jules Simon. And you're like, I didn't see that one coming. Or like, he'll lose a set in the first, like these majors, like he never wins one without dropping a set. Like he's always lost one set. And then you get to the semis and the final and you're like, oh yeah, now it's like, he's going to win.
Yeah.
He's going to win the semi. He's going to win the final. It's like in Australia.
2021 was insane. Like, cause he was like totally struggling. Massive ab.
And now he's just like, oh, I'll just lose the first set. And then I'll come back. And it's like, he keeps doing it again and again now.
But yeah, that was something I was thinking. Like, even if he does win, I can still guarantee you he will lose a random set to someone at some point, probably more than one.
And usually he knows what he's doing because he's pacing himself energy-wise and he's strategic sometimes about letting a set go. And then just like when he has this like ironclad ability to play his best tennis when it matters the most. And it's like, you can't really teach that. Like, it's just...
yeah.
He just has that level of mental toughness, I guess, and combination of experience and going for history, which he's not shy to admit. So that's good. Right.
Yeah, I think he understands himself so well. Like, he knows he has that switch that he can flick and just become perfect. But I think he also understands that once he does, like, the light bulb will burn out after a little bit. And so he knows that, like, until he flicks that switch, he's going to have to be, like, shaky sometimes. But then once he gets to the point where, like, you know, the semis or, like, break point in the final or whatever, then like he's just gonna be in god mode.
Yeah. And yeah, like the other really interesting player is going to be Medvedev. Like, how does he do it at the Australian Open? Because he's defending those final points and he's number 7. It's crazy to see a 7 next to his name. But
could he drop out of the top 10 if he goes out early?
Yeah, I think some other things would have to happen, but it's pretty likely. Like, if he doesn't defend, like, if let's say he loses in the quarters instead of the final, like, he's already dropping almost 1,000 points. So it's,
And it's not like, it's not beyond possibility, right? Like, do you think he'll make the final again? Like, I don't really think so as of now.
Yeah, you can't really say with any confidence. Like, maybe I'm confident he'll get to the fourth round, but that's about it, really. Like, it's not, you know, it's not very, like, we'd have to see I'd have to see some good performances from him leading up to the Australian Open. If he does, I think he's playing in Adelaide along with Djokovic and Felix, Rune, and Sinner, like, they're all playing in that tournament. So that'll be a really good field for a 250.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, that's...
But yeah, I think all the same, Medvedev is still a compelling, like, character in the Australian Open because it doesn't really matter that he's not at his best. Like, if Djokovic gets him in the quarters, like, that's not going to be easy. You can't blast your way through that match, even though he did in the 2021 final. I don't know if he could do it again. It's going to take a lot out of him. Like, you remember him, like, literally shaking in their best of 3 match in the World Tour Finals. Like, I don't think anyone wants to play Medvedev in best of 5, but they're going to have to.
Right. But yeah, like, he's going to have... Yeah, he's still going to have... like you said, it's still going to be a super tough out to beat him just because, like, with that level of return and that serve and that backhand and that octopus like movement, it's just going to be really hard to you can't hit through the guy. You have to hit around him and you have to, you know, expose some of his other flaws, but they're really hard to do because it also comes down to his mental state and what he decides to do in the big points.
But don't hit drop shots. I'd suggest that.
Yeah, and don't hit an underarm serve on match point, for crying out loud.
Oh,
but yeah,
we need to do an entire episode about that moment at some point because that was,
that's just what happens. Like, Medvedev is a little crazy, but it's just, I think that's part of the appeal of watching him.
there's a method to the madness most of the time. Kind of moving into predictions a little bit, like, what would you say are, like, the surest things about 2023? Like, Djokovic winning Wimbledon, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I can still say that Djokovic and Nadal will finish in the top 5.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think that's a pretty sure bet. I think just some combination of Djokovic and Nadal win at least 2 of the 4 majors. I think that seems kind of sure. I'm saying 2 instead of 3, but, you know.
Interesting.
Could be 3.
Just to be safer.
But
yeah,
I still think 3 is more likely than 2. But
okay. So if it is 2 between the Australian Open, Roland Garros, and Wimbledon, which one do you think goes to an outsider?
Oh yeah, then it would have to be Australia because I just think Djokovic has still has the advantage on grass over the experience factor and just like the tier that he's been on. He tends to win these things in bunches. He's already won 4 in a row. Plus, he's going to try to go after Federer's record of 8 Wimbledons. He's going to try to equal that next year.
That's insane. He's probably going to tie that next year. And in 2018, he hits 3. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So I feel like it's going to be the hardcore ones. And of course, the US Open feels like the most open one.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you could see someone like a Felix maybe winning or.
Yeah.
Or maybe Alcaraz repeating. Yeah. Alcaraz repeating. Maybe Felix getting one. Yeah. I mean, and then you do also have a numerous, a lot of other wild cards, and you have a lot of younger players from Next Gen 2.0 coming up with like likes of Jack Draper and Brandon Nakashima, Sebastian Korda, you know, Ben Shelton, who's won like 3 challengers in a row and became the youngest ever player to do that. And his ranking went up from like 600 to 96. So he's like just shot up, and he could be another one of those, I guess you could say, Jensen Brooksby of this year, but like
the increasingly problematic Jensen Brooksby.
Yeah, Brooksby is another one who's really kind of plateaued, hasn't he? Because he's another one who, yeah, like once you get a scouting report on him now you feel like, okay, he doesn't really have a whole lot of offense. But with Shelton, I feel like that could be a little different because he is lefty, he has a really big wide serve. He has some, sustainable patterns that he can repeat over and over. And he has a big forehand, likes to come to the net. He seems pretty athletic. So we'll see if, like, how long that carries over and where his ranking is at the end of the year. But yeah, you just have some players in the mid range there. And then you have Tiafoe, who's capable of going on really big runs. And there's, you know, exciting. Like, you have some wild cards. Yeah, you still have the problematic Kyrgios and Zverevs, but they're, but you know, you can never,
I mean, kind of on Tiafoe, like, best year for the American men in like how long? Like, I feel like 2023 promises to be like between him and Fritz and some others. Like, I, you know, they're dragging, American men's tennis is dragging itself from like the bottom of the pit to like the side of the pit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just like the number of American men now that we have in the top 50. It's quite a lot now. Like, it's almost 1/5 of the tour is American men. Mm-hmm. Like, in the I think Tiafoe and Fritz are still my two at the end of next year that I think will probably finish the highest still. But
yeah, and
Sebastian Korda, if he figures out like, if he just gets a little stronger and if he starts serving bigger and he starts getting a few more consistent results, I feel like he could break that mold. But
I agree.
Then I'm interested to see also what Nakashima does, because having won the Next Gen finals, I mean, like that's proven to be really big for a lot of these players. And he almost beat Kyrgios at Wimbledon. He could have been in the final there. So it's like,
it's
a lot of good talent.
I think kind of like on the WTA, like, if everyone's healthy, we could be headed for some majors where the fields are like stacked. We're getting great matches in like the third and fourth rounds and not just, you know, the last couple.
Especially because like the top 10, I feel like it's loaded because like some players who are in the top 10 right now are not going to be there next year.
Mm-hmm.
Like Hurkacz, I mean, he's going to have to step up a little bit if he wants to be in the top 10. I think Rublev will also have to, you know, have another really good year again.
I'm curious, have
a really big result outside of, you know, outside of winning titles at 250s and 500s.
Can he make the major semis for the first time?
Like a major semifinal would be a really big breakthrough for him.
For sure. I mean, he wasn't far away from that at Roland Garros. You know, took Cilic to the brink, but I think, you know, as good as Cilic was in Paris, like, I think major quarterfinals are usually going to be tougher than that, I would say. I mean, I think Djokovic gets Wimbledon. I think Nadal probably gets Roland Garros. I mean, as much as everyone has improved, like, the best shot to beat him there is still Djokovic. I'd put Alcaraz like a hair behind at this point. I think Djokovic probably gets Australia. It's interesting because, like, even though we have the Next Gen coming on finally, and you know, Alcaraz is there, Rune is improving really fast, you have Sinner, you have Felix, you have a bunch of great players. Like, I think there's still a pretty likely scenario where Djokovic wins Australia and Wimbledon, Nadal wins Roland Garros, and then
it's just up to, like, you know, how many of the Masters 1000s can you get? How many of the other titles can you win? And it's like,
yeah.
yeah, and those will be decided by mostly the tier two players, and it's like, you know, like Tsitsipas. I'm curious to see, like, does he have a really good clay season again? Does he does he back up his semifinal from Australian Open? Does he do better at the U.S. Open? So, like, yeah. And it feels like a pretty big year, I would say, for the Medvedev Tsitsipas sort of mood generation overall, just because they're going to have to, they're not only coming up against Djokovic and Nadal, but the generation behind them, which is like, your Felix Alcaraz, Rune Sinner. It's like,
I think the pressure on Ruud is a little lower just because he had such a great year. Like, this was his best year by far, and I think the others regressed. But I totally agree. Like, for that block of players, like, even though they're in their mid-20s, like, time's running out, you know?
Like, Ruud, like, he had such a good year this year, but I sort of wonder, like, can he equal that? Like, you know,
it's going to be hard to back up.
It's going to be hard to see. But then, like we said, like, there's so many other openings where he didn't play like his very best, so he'll have to take advantage of those, I guess.
Yeah,
but like I feel better about him maybe than I do about Tsitsipas and Zverev, and I wouldn't have said that 2 years ago. So it's
I feel better about him too. Like I don't know if his game is better necessarily, but I think he's become a better player at least for the moment.
Just solid mentally, and you have to respect the rate of improvement because he was eight last year, and he. Like, his backhand is not a weakness anymore. So it's like...
He's become, like, a great defender. And I think that's the difference between him and those two. Like, he, I think, has made much more tangible improvements. I think Tsitsipas and Zverev have not changed that much in the past few years, really.
So it's... it's going to be interesting. Like... I think we can predict a lot of the same players would be in the top 10, but it's possible. Like, we have one or two surprises.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like even Fritz could, like, here's my like hot take about the Americans. I feel like one of Fritz or Tiafoe could get in the top five, maybe. I feel like the bottom end of the top five.
Yeah. I feel good about Fritz because he still has such a low hanging fruit at the majors.
Yeah.
Like, especially the US Open, like, man, if he plays that match like 10 times, he doesn't lose. So it's like, he's got to avoid matches like losses like that, like in the first round to Brandon Holt.
Yeah.
Or like he didn't even play for a lot of this year and he finished number 9. It's like,
yeah. And he only went really deep at one major. So,
yeah. Which was Wimbledon, right? And then Australian Open. Yeah. He had chances to win that match against Tsitsipas as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like,
I think he should gain points there.
Yeah. Yeah, and then same with Felix, because it's
Felix could get in the top five.
Yeah. I wouldn't be shocked to see him in a major final next year,
either
Wimbledon or US Open, because I feel like some of his losses at majors have been very encouraging.
Yeah. I'm excited for where his rivalry with Alcaraz goes as well, because that seems to be a pretty good matchup for him. So if they were to meet like late in, I'd like to see it in best of five. If they could meet in a late round, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, and like at a major again, because we didn't get to see what would happen in that US Open match that took place. And then the other two matches have been on indoor hard court. So it'd be interesting to see outdoors on the other surfaces, how did that play out? And of course, Alcaraz coming back from his oblique tear as well.
Right. That I think is a huge factor, because I think if he comes back to the Australian Open playing like he did in that Miami Madrid stretch, besides Djokovic, it's his to win as much as anyone's. But if that doesn't happen, then it's a lot more up in the air.
Yeah, it's crazy because Alcaraz to me is also the most improved player of this year. And it's he went from 32 to 1. And so he went from a guy like, you know, how many people just get like stuck in the middle? Like they're like, who get stuck between like 10 and 15. And they're like, oh, can he do this next year? And it's like, you have to go step by step by step. But he just like eclipsed all those steps. And now he's like, you know, now he wants to win Wimbledon and he wants to win, get the other two. And now he wants to, like, it's.
He was like ranked 16th by like the middle of the year, right?
Yeah, like in 2030, he's going to be 26 years old.
Yeah.
That alone makes me laugh at this point. Yeah. It's like,
we got so lucky with Świątek and Alcaraz. Like,
I mean, especially for the ATP, because you had Federer retiring this year. And then now it's like, you know, you have the big two, and then you have this guy who's off that same mold, if you like, of like greatness. And he just filled in the spot. It's like,
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. And you would obviously, you know, you would love to see Team get back there. You'd like to see Wawrinka squeeze out the last 1 or 2 years that he has left. Same with Andy Murray, of course. But it's just, I feel like the ATP is in a really good spot because of this Alcaraz burst that they got this year.
Yeah. I think in some ways, like, and you know, if Djokovic and Nadal split the first three majors of the year, this will not happen. But I think in some ways this year, like with the retirements, it was sort of like, and you know, Alcaraz coming up, it was sort of like the start of something. And I wonder if next year is going to be a bit of an indicator of like how the next few years will go. Like next year feels big.
Yeah. And especially because Djokovic and Nadal are not playing that many tournaments. And exactly. you would expect the same thing again next year, to be honest. So there's going to be a lot of opportunities for players at the Masters 1000 level, at the 500 level. And, you know, if Alcaraz does lose early, who's going to take advantage? Who's going to step up? It makes it so exciting, I think.
I can't wait. Forward to it. Yeah.
I can't wait. And of course, we have United Cup coming up, and Nadal is going to be playing in that. We could already have a Nadal Kyrgios potentially by the end of this year. And it's like, then we could too soon for that kind of drama right now. But
I mean,
and then after that, we have the Adelaide tournament, we have some board tennis, and then Australian Open starts, and it's just all going full swing again.
I'm excited to get into it. On that note, I think I need to go eat dinner, but it was good to recap some stuff and look ahead.
It was quite good because we covered so much.
We did cover a lot. This is almost 2 hours, really, or an hour and a half.
I think we did well to keep it under 90 minutes.
Yeah. I'll end the recording.
To our listeners, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year if you're listening to this by the start of 2023. Keep up all the great engagement on social media. Follow us on Twitter. Follow Popcorn Tennis. Follow me at BunchV2K. Follow you at Tennis Nation. Follow Andre at Roland Berg Andre. Make sure to check out his work for Tennis Canada as well. And feel free to rate, comment, subscribe, like, all of that jazz on podcast platforms. And continue listening in 2023 because we'll have some more episodes. Owen will actually be in Australia, so hopefully we'll get some in-house content from Owen. We're not making any promises there, but we're definitely looking forward to have one of our team members there.
Like with this sort of thing, I don't believe it's going to happen until it's happening. So like when I'm there, absolutely, like we will do podcasts. But like right now, it still feels fake in my head. So
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.